Good morning. Today's Friday, October 20th, 2017. My name is Vilma Howard, and I will be reading to you today from the Pantograph. Today I'm starting off with a bit of local news. A normal man faces weapons charges in a domestic dispute. Out of Bloomington, a domestic dispute led to a shot being fired into an empty car in Normal early Wednesday morning. Prosecutors said in court Thursday, Walter Hill, 25 years old, out of the 400 block of West Vernon Avenue in Normal, was charged with possession of a weapon by a felon in McLean County Circuit Court and remains in jail in lieu of posting $5,035. The case remains under investigation and further charges could be added later, prosecutors said. Normal police were called around 4:17 a.m. Wednesday to the area after the altercation between Hill and his girlfriend. A weapon was recovered, police said, in a vehicle in the parking lot had a window that was shattered from a gunshot. There was no injuries reported. Illinois State University issued a crime advisory Wednesday morning, but noted that no students were involved. Anyone with information is asked to contact Sergeant Rob Cherry at the Normal Police Department at 309-454-9726 or at rcherry@normal.org. And moving on, Democrats display extremism. What would America's abortion policy be if the number of months in the gestation of a human infant were a prime number, say even 7 or 11? This thought experiment is germane to why the abortion issue has been politically toxic and points to path towards less bitter debate. The House Representatives has a third time stepped onto this path. Senate Democrats will, for the third time, block this path when Majority Leader Mitch McConnell brings the House bill to the floor, allowing Democrats to demonstrate their extremism and aversion to bipartisan compromise. Democracy, which properly is government by persuasion rather than majority bullying or executive or judicial policy fiats, is a search for splittable differences. Abortion, which supposedly is the main issue that confounds efforts at compromise and has for two generations. Since the Supreme Court seized custody of the issue in 1973, damaged political civility. Pro-abortion abolitionists, meaning those who completely content with the post-1973 regime of essentially unrestricted abortion on demand at any point in the pregnancy, are disproportionately Democrats who, they say, constitute the party of science. They are aghast that the Department of Health and Human Services now refers to protecting people at every stage of life, beginning at conception. This, however, is elementary biology, not obtrusive theology. Something living begins then. This is why it's called conception. In absent of natural malfunction or intentional intervention, abortion. Conceptions result in human birth. In 1973, the court decreed without basis in a constitutional text, structure or history or embryology or other science, a trimester policy. It's postulated without scintilla of reasoning, moral or constitutional significance, in a banal convenience that 9 is divisible by 3. The court decided that the right to abort becomes trifle less than absolute. In a practice not discernibly less, when the fetus reaches viability, meaning the ability to survive without the womb. The court stipulates that viability arrives at 24 to 28 weeks. On October 3rd, the House passed 237 to 189 the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act banning abortions, with the usual exceptions concerning rape, incest, and the life of the mother after the 20th week. The Act's supposition is that by then the fetus will feel pain when experiencing the violence of being aborted, and that this matters. Of course, pro-abortion abolitionists consider the phrase unborn child oxymoronic, believing that from conception until the instant of delivery, the preborn infant is a mere fetal material, as devoid of moral significance as would be a tumor in the, if they will pardon the provocative expression, mother. Whether a 20-week fetus has neurological pathways sufficient for feeling pain is merely a question that science can answer, if it's not already. Already there are myriad intrauterine medical procedures, some involving anesthesia. Doctors can heal lives that America's extremely permissive abortion laws say can be terminated with impunity. Only 7 nations allow unrestricted abortions after 20 weeks. Most European nations restrict abortions by at least 13 weeks. France and Germany are very restrictive after 12 weeks. Sweden after 18. Getting a scientific answer to the pain question, even if it's a yes, should gratify the party of science. If the answer is yes, those who think fetal suffering is irrelevant can explain why they do. New medical technologies and techniques are lowering the age of viability. An increasingly vivid sonogram showing beating hearts and moving fingers make it increasingly difficult to argue that fetal material is at no point in any way a baby. Science presenting inconvenient truths to the party of science, truths that are reasons the percentage of pregnancies aborted is the smallest since 1973. In 1973, the court bizarrely called the fetus potential life, it is, of course, undeniably alive and biologically human, a large American majority is undogmatic because uncertain about the House bill does not address the question of when the living thing that begins at conception should be held to acquire personhood protectable by law. This majority's commonsensical, prudently imprecise, split-the-difference answer is not at conception, but well before completed gestation. Hence, this majority, its vocabulary provided by the court's arbitrarily jurisprudence, think first trimester abortions, more than 90% of abortions, should be legal, after which approximately 2/3 majority supports restricting abortions. When the sooner the better, the House bill comes to the Senate floor, Democrats will prevent the vote on it. This will be a tutorial on the actual extremist in our cultural conflict. And now, moving on, in a bit of major news, attack details are sought. Members of Congress demand answers Thursday, 2 weeks after an ambush in the African nation of Niger killed 4 U.S. soldiers, with one top lawmaker even threatening subpoenas. The White House defended the slow pace of information, saying an investigation would eventually offer clarity about a tragedy that has morphed into a political dispute in the United States. Among the unresolved inquiries, why were the Americans apparently caught by surprise? Why did it take 2 additional days to recover one of the 4 bodies after the shooting stopped? Was the Islamic State responsible? The confusion over what happened in a remote corner of Niger, where few Americans travel, has increasingly dogged President Donald Trump, who was silent about the deaths for more than a week. Asked why, Trump on Monday turned the topic into a political tussle by crediting himself with doing more to honor the dead and console their families than any of his predecessors. His subsequent boasts that he reached out personally to all families of the fallen was contradicted by interviews with family members, some of whom had not heard from Trump at all. And then an aunt of an army sergeant killed in Niger, who raised the soldier as her son, said Wednesday that Trump had shown disrespect to the soldier's loved ones as he telephoned to extend condolences while family members were driving to the Miami airport to receive his body. Sergeant L. A. David Johnson was one of the 4 Americans killed on October 4th in southwest Niger. Trump called the families of all 4 Tuesday. In an extraordinary White House briefing, John Kelly, the former Marine general who is Trump's chief of staff, described himself as stunned and brokenhearted by the criticism of Trump. The deadly ambush in Niger occurred as an Islamic militant on motorcycles tooting rocket-propelled grenades and heavy machine guns seized on a U.S. convoy and shattered the windows of their armored trucks. In addition to those killed, two Americans were wounded. No extremist groups have claimed responsibility. The attack is under official military investigation as normal for a deadly incident. What is abnormal? According to Senator John McCain, the Republican chairman of Senate Armed Services Committee, is the Trump administration's slow response to request for information. He said Thursday it may take a subpoena to shake loose more information. Senator Bob Corker, the Tennessee Republican who chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said members of Congress have been provided with some information about the attack, but not what we should. At the Pentagon, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis pushed back, saying it naturally takes time to verify information about a combat engagement. He promised to provide accurate information as soon as it's available, but offered no timetable. And moving on to a bit of sports news, Hernandez leads Dodgers to World Series. In Chicago, Enrique Hernandez put a Hollywood ending on the LA story 3 decades in the making. Fueled by Hernandez's home run trilogy, Clayton Kershaw, the Los Angeles Dodgers are finally going to the World Series. Hernandez homered 3 times and drove in 7 runs. Kershaw breezed through 6 crisp innings, and Los Angeles ended the Chicago Cubs' title defense with an 11-1 victory in Game 5 of the National League Championship Series on Thursday night. "It feels good to hear World Series," Kershaw says. "It's been a long time coming for this team. After years of playoff heartbreaks and heartaches, there are just no stopping this group of Dodgers," with Kershaw firing away at the top of the deep pitching staff and Justin Turner anchoring a tough lineup. One of baseball's most storied franchises captured its first pennant since the Hall of Fame Tommy Lasorda managed Los Angeles in its last championship in 1988. The Dodgers will host New York Yankees or Houston Astros in Game 1 of the World Series on Tuesday night. The Yankees have a 3-2 lead in the ALCS heading into Game 6 at Houston on Friday night, so one more New York win would set up another chapter in an old October rivalry between the Yankees and the Dodgers. And the Dodgers made the playoffs 8 times in the previous 13 season and came up short each time, often with Kershaw shouldering much of the blame. And now, continuing on in sports, the Astros fight to stay alive in the ALCS. Justin Verlander agreed to that last-minute trade to the Houston Astros with hopes of another World Series, and has since won all 8 games he has pitched. 8 is not enough. The Astros have to win Verlander's 9th game, or their season will end short of that goal. "Obviously, I know this is one of the main reasons I was brought here," Verlander said Thursday. "This is why I'm here." 6 days after the big right-hander threw a complete game against the New York Yankees to put Houston up 2-0 in the best-of-7 all-championship series, the teams will be back in Minute Maid Park for Game 6 on Friday night, with the Astros facing an elimination game after the New York Yankees swept 3 games in Bronx. "Well, there's immediate belief when you have Justin Verlander go," manager A.J. Hinch said. "His presence will immediately make everybody sit up straight, stand up a little bit more, have a little bit more energy because of the presence that he brings." Astros certainly need the boost. Aaron Judge and all those baby boomers from the New York who had a pair of 2-1 losses in Houston and struck out 13 times against Verlander definitely have a lot more energy and confidence after outscoring the Astros 19-5 and outhitting them 25-12 in their 3-home game. And they have already turned the tables on Dallas Keuchel and the other Astro ace, who lost Game 5 after winning the series opener with 10 strikeouts over 7 scoreless innings. Look at a number of other players that have been through the playoffs, and they've had their struggles, and all of a sudden, they can get hot, Yankees manager Joe Girardi says, and I think everything is magnified when you're in the playoffs. The two games seems like forever, where if you're struggling two games in the season, most people don't say much. The Yankees are one win away from their first AL pennant since 2009, and record 41st overall. Houston has to win Verlander's start and then another game for its first AL pennant. The Astros were still in the National League for their World Series appearance 12 years ago. Verlander in Game 2 threw 124 pitches, exactly twice as many as Luis Severino did for the Yankees. That is also starting matchup for Game 6. Severino didn't take the mound for the fifth inning in Game 2, an inning after Girardi and a trainer visited the mound after the 23-year-old right-hander uncharacteristically wound his arm several times soon after giving up a solo homer to Carlos Carrera. He stayed in then, but then he was struck on the wrist of his no-throwing hand by a one-hopper that was the inning-ending out. Afterwards, Severino said he was fine and that checked out, and that he was checked out with the doctors and that he wanted to keep pitching. Now he gets his chance to pitch the Yankees into the World Series. My excitement level is, I think, it's at 100, Severino says, adding he felt great after a good bullpen session on Wednesday. Verlander made two World Series starts as a rookie with Detroit in 2006 and made it again in 2012 with the Tigers, who completed a trade in August 31st to send him to Houston only minutes before the deadline for him to be eligible to pitch in the postseason. So what did the 34-year-old Verlander do in between starts after the 124 pitches last Saturday? I kind of stepped onto the gas. I feel as good now as I felt all year, Verlander said. This is what we worked so hard for. My workout regimen in the offseason, my throwing regimen, my shoulder regimen in the season, all that stuff. This is when it pays off the most. I came off that start better than almost any I have all year. This ALCS so far has followed the same pattern as the 2001 World Series for the New York, which then lost its first two games at Arizona before winning three in a row at Yankee Stadium. That's where the Yankees would like the similarities to end, since they lost 15-2 in Game 6 against Randy Johnson when Andy Pettitte started tipping his pitches. Roger Clemens started Game 7 for the Yankees against Curt Schilling, but it was Johnson who got his third win of the World Series pitching in relief after the Diamondbacks scored twice in the ninth off Mariano Rivera for a 3-2 victory. After having to win the AL wildcard game over Minnesota, then overcoming a 0-2 deficit to win the best of five in AL Division Series, the Yankees are suddenly in an unusual position this postseason, leading a series. Yeah, it does feel different, Girardi says. We've been on and we've had to win today. We can't afford to lose today for a number of reasons, but I still think the attitude will be the same. Win one game, that is what we've kind of talked about, and that's all we struck around here to do, win one game. And now moving on to the obituaries for the day. Clark Romer, Clark W. Romer, 87 years old, of Lexington, passed away at 9:32 p.m. on Tuesday at his home where he had been ill with heart problems since August. William Ray Martin, 96 years old, of Clinton, passed away at 3:15 p.m. at Manor Court in Clanton on Wednesday. Roger Lee Lawrence, of Bellflower, passed away at 8:05 a.m. on Monday in Canton. Richard R. Tuggle, 92 years old, of Clinton, passed away at 3:05 p.m. on Tuesday in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Betty Klein, 89 years old, of Carrollton, Texas, formerly of Pontiac, died at 8:45 a.m. on Sunday at the home of her daughter in Carrollton, Texas. Kenneth Lee Slater, 69 years old, passed away Sunday at his home with his loving wife by his side following a brief, though valiant, battle with cancer. And Lena May Harper, 84 years old, of Hudson, passed away at 10:25 a.m. on Tuesday. And now, moving on to the next article. In 2 weeks leading up to Thursday's big announcement, four University Illinois basketball recruiting targets chose other schools. Iowa State, Michigan, Virginia Tech, Arizona State all grabbed Illinois' coach Brad Underwood's hoped to add to his roster. But with the help of a brief video, an orange black eye, all that disappointment vanished Thursday. For the second time in 6 months, Underwood has orchestrated a major recruiting coup within the borders of his home state. Anyo Dosunmu, the five-star guard from Chicago Morgan Park, made his recruiting decision in a unique ceremony at Jordan Brand's store near the heart of Chicago's Loop, after a short black-and-white video showing Dosunmu handling a basketball and the room lights drew low, and he walked from the darkness amid cheers wearing a white golf shirt with a black eye. "I can only pick one school, and I've decided to stay home," he said, choosing the Illini over his other finalists, Wake Forest. "It was tough, so many pros and cons, but at the end of the day, I had a chance to build my legacy and make it here. I think I'm the best point guard in the country, and the best way to prove it is in my home state." Dosunmu obviously connected with the Underwood, and he already had a trusted connection with the Illini assistant coach Ronald Chin Coleman, who once coached the Mark Irvin Fire AAU team that Dosunmu plays for now. Coleman and Dosunmu's father, Quan, are longtime friends. Underwood got Dosunmu's attention when he showed him how his fast-paced offense rewards guards and reminds him that his team has led the nation in points scored within the first 7 seconds of the shot clock. "That's intriguing to pay the fast," Dosunmu said. "I think Underwood can get me to the next level," Dosunmu said. "He said I could have the ball right away. He told me I could have a lot of minutes coming out." Dosunmu averaged 22 points and 7 rebounds and 9 assists and 2 steals last season for Morgan Park, which won the IHSA Class 3A title, even though Dosunmu injured his foot in the semifinal game and did not play in the title contest. He becomes the first 5-star recruit to pick Illinois since D. Brown in 2002. Dosunmu wears uniform number 11, just like former Illini Brown, who happens to be his favorite player. "I just wanted to be different," Dosunmu said after he was reminded that other Chicago 5-star players have opted to go to schools like Duke and Kansas. "Not many 5-star recruits have decided to stay home. I wanted to change the culture." Dosunmu said he made his decision 3 days ago, but kept it a secret, even from the college coaches, until Thursday night. The commitment from Dosunmu comes the day before Chicago Simon 4-star wing Talen Horner-Tucker begins his visit to the Illini campus. He's also strongly considering Xavier and Iowa State, but would add another highly rated Chicago recruit to Underwood's class if he picked the Illini. And now, moving on to our life section and a bit of local news out of Eureka. For more than 30 years, Patty Koof has screened thousands of women for breast cancer as a mammography technologist at the Advocate Eureka Hospital. "I am the caregiver, not the patient," Cuff said in her Eureka home last week. For years, Grant Cuff, Patty's adult son, led a healthy life. "I was in fantastic shape and ready to start my career," Grant said. But in 2012, Patty was diagnosed with breast cancer and had bilaterally a mastectomy, and Grant was diagnosed with an aggressive testicular cancer and given 20% chance of survival. "It was a roller coaster ride," said Patty's husband and Grant's father, Jim, 59 years old, a retired uniform carpenter. "Cancer doesn't care who you are, how old you are, what you do for a living," Patty said, now 54 years old. "What my mom and both my parents went through was crazy," said Grant, now 27 years old. "What we dealt with still hasn't sunk in. I don't know how my parents did it." Patty and Jim married and moved to Eureka in 1986, the same year that Patty, a Dallas City native, began as a mammography tech at the hospital. They have 3 children, Courtney, 29, Grant, and Emily, 24. "My health was good, and I would get yearly mammograms and pap smears, Patty recalled. Grant exercised 6 days a week. In early May 2012, Patty detected an indentation in her left breast, but decided to wait to have it checked until after Emily's high school graduation. Grant graduated from college that same month and moved to Kansas and began work as a technician at a nuclear power station in Burlington. A few days later, he detected a nickel-sized lump on his testicles. He had a sonogram and was told that he had testicular cancer. "I was totally blindsided," Grant said, "but the next morning I got into my car and drove 500 miles for my sister's graduation party. At that time, I didn't know how bad things were." A week later, we found out. Grant had a CT, computed tomography, scan, and met with a specialist who told him that the cancer had spread to his lungs. How could someone who exercised, never did drugs, never did any drinking, get devastating cancer that could kill you, he asked. It was a shock. A horror, Jim said. Grant had outpatient surgery to remove the testicle, but his tumor markers remained elevated. So he was referred to IU Health, Melvin and Bren Simon Cancer Center in Indianapolis, where he found out in June 2012 that the cancer had also spread to his brain and abdomen. That explained his blurred vision, coughing, and headaches. "He was mad as hell," his father said. Jim stayed with Grant, who had immediately admitted to Simon to begin chemotherapy, and Patty needed to return to Eureka for work to address her own ill health. "I was losing weight because I couldn't eat, because she was worried about Grant," Patty said. Her weight loss made the indentation in her left breast more pronounced. She was diagnosed. She had a diagnostic mammogram and a biopsy, and on June 26, 2012, she was told she had breast cancer. "I was in disbelief," she said. "I knew it couldn't happen to me at the same time my son was sick. Besides, I am a mammographer. I don't get breast cancer. We diagnose it." "I was numb," Jim admitted. "The probabilities of a son and mother being diagnosed with cancer a month apart are so slim." Patty saw a radiation oncologist, medical oncologist, breast health navigator, and plastic surgeon. Because her type of cancer, invasive lobular carcinoma, was likely to spread to her other breasts, she elected to have a surgical removal of both breasts with immediate reconstruction. She had the surgery this next month. "When I got home from the hospital, my older sister came to stay with me. It was really hard for me not to have my husband there, but we agreed to put Grant first." Patty's second phase of the reconstructive surgery was a few months later. She didn't need radiation or chemo. Meanwhile, Grant had 4 courses of chemotherapy. "I'd lost my ability to drive. My memory got terrible. I was vomiting and dizzy every day." His tumor markers remained high, so he returned to Simon, where he had double stem cell bone marrow transplant. His stem cells were harvested, and he received high-dose chemo, losing hair, weight, and energy. To kill his white blood cells, then his stem cells were returned. Because his immune system was gone during treatments, he remained at Simon. "You just keep pushing. I did it for my parents, for my family." He was lonely, but his spirits were raised when some high school friends hosted a benefit that raised $30,000 to help his parents with expenses. In December, he was allowed to return to work and immediately drove to Kansas. "I wanted to start my life," Grant said. "It was important for me to keep this new job, which his company had kept for him, even though he had been unable to work for only four days since May. In a world of crazy businesses, here, people still come first," he said. His insurance was phenomenal, Jim said. His treatment was in the millions of dollars. Grant began taking chemotherapy pills as he returned to work the following May. He had surgery to remove the 29th lymph nodes from his abdomen. "I have not been on any medication since that surgery." That does conclude my reading for the day. Thank you all for listening. Today is again Friday, October 20th, 2017. My name is Vilma Howard. Thank you for listening.